Doesn't seem to be any way of changing that. So we'll just have to change our reactions to it, huh? Only thing we can do. We'll have to start liking it. Maybe we have to think that would be much worse if it was snow and ice and sleet and hail. Well, we wouldn't like that at all. So maybe we can say, well, we like this better. Something of that nature. We're going to talk about the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We've talked about the first one, the body, huh? And we have pretty well exhausted that, although one could say more about it, but we've pretty well exhausted the possibilities of getting at it, the various ways of contemplating it and becoming aware. And there are four altogether, four foundations, four ways of becoming mindful. So I'm not going to do them in the order 1, 2, 3, 4, but I'm going to go to number four. Now, number four are the contents of our thoughts. Contents of the thoughts. And the first one, the body one, Kaya Nupasana, and the last one is the Dhamma Nupasana. Now, that Pali word denotes a certain thing that we need to be aware of in our thoughts. And there are quite a whole string of do's and don'ts, what we should have in our thoughts and what we shouldn't have. The first thing that we shouldn't have in our thoughts are the five hindrances. And, of course, they come in so many different guises that it's not easy to know what is happening. That's why we should be sure that we at least know these five hindrances by name so that we can recognize them. It's much easier to recognize something if you have a name to it. If you put a name to it, and when you have a name to it, you immediately have a characteristic. So our five hindrances are, first one is the craving for the gratification of sensual desire. In other words, we'd like to have it pleasant, like to have nice sense contact. And the second one is called ill will. So the first one can call greed, and the second one can call hate. But in the five hindrances, their names are like as such as I've given. Gratification of sensual desire and ill will. And these, of course, are our main problems, those two. And the third one is called sloth and torpor. Or also you can call it laziness and drowsiness. And obviously it's a feature of both, of greed and hate. It's a feature of greed, I like to have it comfortable, and of hate, I don't really want to strain myself. So both are embedded in that. And we find an enormous number of justifications for that particular one. The first two, we don't even have to find justifications, we just do them automatically. But the third one, we find justifications. Why we can't do what we actually know we should be doing. It's particularly one of those that we use instead of daily meditating. Instead of sitting down every day, morning and evening, and meditating, we have a string of explanations why we can't do that. Basically, it's all the third hindrance. That's all it is. And we will find out that there are that in the factors of enlightenment, there's one that is an antidote for that. And the fourth one is worry and restlessness. Now, worry is very much about what we call our personal problems, the future, how it's going to work out, achievement syndrome, result thinking, what I want to become, what I think I'm not yet. And restlessness is that feature that we have within us where we're not contented and satisfied. So it's these are all very normal human reactions, but that doesn't mean that they make anybody happy. In fact, they make everybody unhappy. But most people have no way of knowing what it's like to be without them, or without at least one of them or two of them. So one considers, most people consider it to be the normal way of being. And justifications or the arguments are, yes, but everybody's doing it, or one must have some way of becoming something, or if you don't worry about things, how are you going to approach them? And all these kind of things that will tell the mind that it's all right what we're doing. But the only criteria, whether it's all right what we're doing or not, is whether we have inner happiness and peace, independent of outer conditions. Whether the things we like are actually happening or not, nothing to do with it. So that's the only criteria, whether what we're doing is okay. And if it isn't, if we don't have inner peace and happiness, that doesn't mean that we now have to change our living quarters or change our partner or change our diet or change our teacher or anything like that. It just means that we've got to change our reactions. That's all. And as soon as we do that, it's all different. Everything's different. So that's the only criteria to use. Am I really peaceful and happy, no matter what happens out there? And obviously, the answer has to be no, because only the Arahant, the enlightened one, is peaceful and happy no matter what happens out there. But the next question can be also, how often am I not peaceful and happy? Half the day, every day? 3/4 of the day? The whole day? Every second day? Find out. And nobody needs to know about this, only yourself. And the more you realize that the inner peace and happiness are escaping you, the more important it becomes to do something about these hindrances. So that was the fourth one, restlessness, worry and restlessness. And the fifth one is called skeptical doubt. Skeptical doubt is traditionally said to be about the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha. It's a traditional way of looking at it. There are so many traditional ways of looking at things. That is the difficulty of, first of all, that language changes its value system. For instance, the word mistress used to mean the lady of the house. Then it used to mean somebody that one had an affair with, was his mistress. And now we don't use it at all. Who uses the word mistress? Nobody. Language changes its value system, and it changes it very, very quickly. Not just over thousands of years, but over just decades it changes it. And we have lots of words like that, but I'm just going to use this one as an example because it's very clear. So this business about the skeptical doubt in the scriptures, it says about the enlightenment of the Buddha, the veracity of the Dhamma, and the ability of the Sangha to propagate it for us. Well, of course people do have doubts, naturally, until they have found out themselves. But the worst doubt, and the most insidious doubt that we get, is doubt about ourselves, about our own capacity and our own ability to actually follow such a lofty path which leads to enlightenment. The doubt about our own ability, and also the doubt, which also often comes up, that one can live in the world while pursuing this path. That's a very common consideration that people have. Because the life in the world is geared towards greed and hate, wanting and not wanting. And this path is geared towards the opposite. So can one actually live in the world pursuing this path? Naturally, one can. In fact, one can be a great boon to those people that one has anything to do with, because they can learn that it's possible to be different without any great problems or any problems arising. But the difficulty that a practitioner encounters is the influence of the people that one is connected with, that one has dealings with, and everything that these people think and say and do, because it's just the opposite of the Dhamma. And if we get enough influence because of the fact that we want to be supported by them, we can't practice properly. It happens again and again. We practice, so to say, on the outer edges. Sit down and meditate a bit, look at the Dhamma book now and then, remember that there's dukkha when it gets too bad, might even remember that things change. But that's not enough, is it? The world does the opposite. Just exactly the opposite. And this is the reason why the Buddha said after his enlightenment, teaching will be a vexation for me, because people can't do this. It's too difficult for them to change their mind. And then he saw that there were some people who were wide open for this. That's the ones he tried to teach them. And he found quite a number of those. We have the same difficulty. And this is the insidious doubt. Can I really do this? Is it worth my while to do it? Again, the only criteria is, am I happy? Am I peaceful? Or am I reactive? What am I doing? Or am I looking around, searching for something that's going to give me what I want? Or have I already understood that nobody and nothing can give me what I want, that I've got it all inside of me, and that all I have to do is let go of everything that's cluttering it up? So these five are called the five hindrances. They are, so to say, our enemies. And they are constantly available. They don't just come on certain days or when there are certain situations, but they are part and parcel of the human heart and mind. The Buddha has similes for them, which makes it maybe a little easier to remember them. It's very important to remember them. If we don't remember them, we can't really do anything about them. The first one, the gratification of sensual desire, is compared to being in debt. We are in debt to our senses. We want to pay off this debt by getting pleasant sense contacts. And obviously, since all sense contacts are very short-lived, we have to keep on paying with interest. And if we don't do anything about it, we'll still be paying on our deathbed. We'll still want it pleasant rather than most unpleasant at the time. So we can do something now about it, which doesn't mean, and I want to warn about this misunderstanding, which does arise frequently, that the Buddha means we shouldn't have pleasant sense contact. He doesn't. We have both. We have pleasant and unpleasant. Sometimes the weather is just right and it's okay. And sometimes it's too hot and sometimes it's too cold. And all the other sense contacts, sometimes okay and sometimes not. But what arises out of this understanding that this is like being in debt and that we can never satisfy our inner yearning through our sense contacts, arising out of that comes a letting go of a constant search for the pleasant sense contact. It also is a letting go of the idea that the world has in it somewhere, if I could just find it, perfection, utopia. If I only eat the right things, think the right things, meet the right people, and then the next step is, I'm imagining I'm doing it. Everything is great. And why do I still not feel peaceful if everything is so great? Why are there still problems? It's imagination. The world is not paradise. The world is not utopia. The world is sense contact. Some of it pleasant, some of it unpleasant. Some of it neutral, of course, and necessary for this body to live in. That's all the world is. Nothing more. We need it. We need to make a living so we can eat and have a roof over our heads. But that isn't going to satisfy the yearning for peace and for inner stability and completeness. So what we need to recognize is that running after pleasantness, believing everything is okay, doesn't help. And hoping everything is going to be okay, or trying to find that which is nice, none of that helps. When we have pleasant sense contact, we're grateful for it. And when we have unpleasant sense contact, we see in it a learning situation. That's all. It's really very simple. Well, we don't make up stories. Now, this is not so uncommon. Some people make up stories. They don't really see what's going on. They see what they would like to see. And imagination and reality never come together. There's always a gap in between. Because of that, there's no peace. The reality always falls short of the imagination. Now, not everybody does that. Some people have more imagination for how they think things are than others. Others have more imagination in the negative sense. They think everything is just horrible. Well, it's just as wrong. Also doesn't come together with reality. It's both. So, the change which comes about when we don't run after these pleasant sense contacts is the understanding that they come and they go. We don't have to look for them. They arise. And when they're there, we don't have to try and keep them. They stay just as long as any of the sense contacts is able to stay. We can't look at the same thing forever, neither hear it, taste it, touch it, or smell it. It's all very short-lived. And it doesn't bring satisfaction. But while it is happening, when it's pleasant, it gives a certain pleasure to us, which we can be grateful for. But if we don't run after them and try to find them, we open up a lot of energy and time, which we can use more profitably. And also, if our sense contacts, the pleasant ones, if we are grateful for them, but don't want to hang on to them, and don't want to repeat them, it's a pure sense contact, and has far more impact. Because trying to hang on to it and trying to keep it, or trying to repeat it, is an interruption of the pleasure. Just think of seeing a beautiful sunset. Now, if you look at this beautiful sunset, no person in their right mind would try and keep that sunset there. Everybody knows it's going to go within minutes. So you're not trying to keep it. But probably, most likely thinking, I'd like to see that again. Repeat it. So it's already an impurity put into the experience. Whereas if you just have the experience without any of the extraneous matters, thoughts, then the experience becomes one of unity consciousness, where you and the sunset become one. And then it has a real feeling of fulfilling oneself, very short-lived, but at least at that time. I've talked about that already, but it is here again pertinent. So the gratification of sensual desire is something that everybody lives with, and some people have more problem with it than others. Those that have less problem with the gratification of sensual desire then have more problem with the next one, with ill will. We, in the Abhidhamma, the Pugala Panyata, which is a book of the Abhidhamma where the different characters of people are described, the main classification that it starts out with is greed characters and hate characters. Now, greed characters are easier to live with and have a nicer life because they're always hoping something nice is going to happen. So they're always living in hope, and which makes them a little more tractable and easier to get along with. Now, the hate character thinks everything is awful, and not only everything but everybody. Very difficult to live with, and finds life very difficult, but can be relied upon to practice, whereas the greed character not. The greed character cannot be relied upon because there are too many pleasant sensations that the greed character dreams up and tries to find. So both have their positive and negative sides. The hate character is definitely someone who will practice, because it's very unpleasant to have that feeling of hate within. It's like burning, the burning sensation, and very anxiety producing and restlessness producing. Now, this doesn't mean that the greed character hasn't got any hate, nor that the hate character hasn't got any greed. Not at all. We all have all five. It just means that one is more prevalent than the other. That's all. It comes to the fore more often. Now, if we can recognize which one of those we are, we know where we have to do the most work. And it's not difficult to recognize how our mind usually behaves. So this is the first one is the simile is for being in debt. And the second one, the ill will, or hate, dislike, the simile is a bilious disease, a bile coming up. Well, it's very fitting, isn't it? One certainly feels ill at ease when one has ill will. And again, our problems with these things are that we justify both of them. We cannot distinguish, mostly cannot distinguish, between need and greed. And that's something we really need to learn, to distinguish between need and greed. It's not an easy thing to do, because particularly when we live in a fairly well-to-do society where so many things are taken for granted, which are designed for nothing but comfort, we take it for granted that we ought to have them. Well, ought we really? It's an investigation. Or are we very lucky that we do have certain things and can be grateful for them? A gratitude is a very important aspect of the practice and should be developed as much and often as possible. It's also one of the loving-kindness meditations, a very important one. One can start one's meditation with a few moments of gratitude that one is able to do this, that one has the opportunity and the surroundings, the companions, the teacher, all these things that one can be grateful for. It helps to concentrate the mind. So when we look at our inner situation, we can easily find which one of these two makes things more difficult for us. And we will probably find that there is alternate movement, sometimes this, sometimes that. But if we look more closely, we'll see that one of them is more often represented, either the greed one or the hate one. And having this dis-ease, ill at ease, of ill will, we have to, if we want to be peaceful and happy, we have to let go of every justification. There is no justification. There are things wrong in the world. Well, of course there are. It's not paradise out there. It's not even paradise within the heart. Sure, there are things wrong. But is there anybody to blame? Is there anything that we can do about it? If there is, well, let's go and do it. But if there isn't, why even think about it? If something touches us personally, where somebody is unpleasant or we don't get what we want, well, what else is there to do except to look at it and say, well, that's the way things are at this moment. And they too will change. So it's compared to bilious disease. The third one, sloth and torpor, is compared to being in prison. One can't do much. one is imprisoned. Obviously we have our own key, but sometimes we don't feel like using it or don't quite know how to use it. Some people are not so bothered by this one. One can say that sloth and torpor is a hindrance which the people who have more greed have more problem with. But that's a generalization. It need not be always so. But it's a general statement and can often be true. And then there is the fourth one, worry and restlessness, and that's considered or compared to being a slave or being pushed here and there by worry. We worry about the most absurd things. For instance, people worry about their old age, and they might die when they're young. It's really laughable. And some people worry about, for instance, about the government, what they're going to do. Any point in worrying about this? Some people worry about the atomic bomb. Some people worry about slaughter of animals. The only thing that has any productiveness in it is if we can actually do something. In German there is a very nice verse, not by the Buddha but by one famous writer, but in English it doesn't make a verse, but the meaning is, there is nothing good unless we do it. In German it's a verse. Es gibt nichts Gutes, außer man tut es. And it's a very important thing to remember. A very famous German writer wrote that. What is there to think about? If we can do it, do it. If we can't, that's it. We aren't almighty. And, you know, we only know that where we put our mind. And from that, maybe, you can already fathom that most people put their mind in the wrong places. For instance, on worry. Worry is very much bound up with ambition. Am I going to get what I want? Very much bound up with achievement syndrome or result thinking, with becoming something rather than being. What in heaven's name do we want to become? We are. And if we can't be, we won't become either. Because only that being now is the foundation for becoming, for instance, enlightened. Only being now is possible, nothing else. So worry is putting one's mind in the wrong place, about all the wrong things, which are constantly concerned with me and mine, my family, my body, maybe my country, my neighbors, or whoever, whatever we are thinking of. Totally unnecessary. Being a slave. People who do that have no way of finding happiness at all, because the mind gets very much accustomed to doing that. So the simile is being a slave. And the last one, the simile is a travel in the desert without provisions and without a road map, going around in circles. Doubt makes one go around in circles. Doubt is also very much bound up with indecision, is this better or is that better? Can I do it? Can I not do it? That's doubt. And so it goes around in circles in the mind. It's very debilitating, because we would, in such a case, think about the same thing over and over and over. Extremely boring, I would say. These five hindrances are part of our mind states, and they are the ones that we should be aware of and try to substitute with their opposites. Now, that happens as we learn in meditation to substitute all discursive thinking, or as much of it as we can, with attention to the meditation subject. Again and again. We do that over and over again. Now, in daily living, we have the opportunity to substitute any of these hindrances and all their derivatives with their opposites, with the wholesome ones. Now, obviously, for instance, ill will has as a derivative fear, and desire for sensual gratification has as a derivative feeling uncomfortable and reacting to that. I mean, there are any number of small matters that are all, can all be put under these five headings. The justifications which we bring up, they show us which one of the derivative we were using. I mean, if we, for instance, are worrying about something, and we justify it with, well, if I don't worry about it, nobody else will. That's something you hear very often, huh? Then the question is, why should anybody worry about it? So the justification that we bring up shows us that we actually want to use our mind in this way, which means that we're using the mind wrongly. And anything that we use the mind wrongly, the criteria is, does it make me happy? Am I really happy? Well, most people don't even know what it's like to be happy without a cause. They know they're happy if somebody gives them a present, or if somebody praises them, or if they have some success. But that's about all they know, how to be happy. To have inner happiness because the Dhamma has arisen within, most people have no idea how to do that. So worry or anxiety or restlessness or indecision or fear or cravings, desires, they all belong under these five main headings. And the criteria is always, does this particular mind state make me happy or doesn't it? And if it doesn't, well, must be something wrong with it. Where does it belong? Into which one of these five categories does it belong? So then, as we've learned in meditation to substitute, we do that in daily living. Again and again and again. And if we actually want to practice a spiritual path, if we don't substitute the unwholesome with the wholesome, we haven't started yet. We can meditate every day, morning an hour, evening an hour. If we don't substitute our unwholesome thoughts with the wholesome ones in daily living, there's no spiritual path. It's all wishful thinking. There's a lot of wishful thinking going on in the spiritual path because you can't grab it, you know. There's nothing solid that you can hang on to. So there's a lot of wishful thinking going on. But if you actually do substitute, You don't have to wish. It's happening. That is what's happening. You can't do anything more important. Because once you even do it once or twice, you recognize that we don't have to keep our minds where they were. We can put them somewhere else. The Buddha was asked once whether he's omniscient. He said no. He doesn't know everything at once. He knows whatever he puts his mind on. It's the same for us, as far as our knowing goes. Wherever we put our mind, that's what we know. So, if, for instance, we put our mind on wanting something, desiring, well, that's what we know. We know sensual desire. And if we don't take care and change that, we believe, of course, that this is the way it ought to be. And not only that, but everybody's doing it, and I might even have a chance to gratify the desire. So, and it's maybe quite a pleasant thought, but it's also dukkha producing. Because, am I going to get the desire? And if I've got it, can I keep it? And the answer is, of course, no, I can't. Nobody can keep anything. Everything is constant movement. So instead of keeping the mind on the desire, which is only creating anxiety within, the anxiety being the dukkha, the anxiety being, I want to get it, I want to grab it, I want to have it, and I want to keep it. We can do several things. The first thing is, and which is the most difficult, but which is the most effective, is to drop it. Let go of it. But it's the most difficult. Only the trained mind can do that. The trained mind can drop whatever it doesn't want to hang on to. That's the first possibility. And the second possibility is to change it into, instead of wanting to have, wanting to give. Well, that makes a world of difference. We may not be able to give exactly that what we were craving for, but everybody has something to give. Time, skill, money, things, attention, love, support. Everybody's got something to give. So instead of wanting to have something, wanting to give. The desire for the sensual gratification immediately vanishes, has to, because we can't do two things at once. Very favorable. We can always come back to it, of course, but we can't do two things at once. So we have changed. Now that's the second possibility. And the third one, if we can't do that, if we can neither drop nor change or substitute, then what we need to do is think of something entirely different, unrelated, which has no desire in it, so that the mind gets away from this unwholesomeness and quietens down, becomes peaceful, and can then try again to be giving instead of wanting. This is sort of an intermittent step. It's an help on the way, and sometimes can be very useful. So if we can't change our I would like this to happen. I would like somebody to approve of me and appreciate me. And instead of changing that immediately into the opposite of giving approval and appreciation, we can't do it. It doesn't work. Think of a beautiful meadow with flowers. The mind quietens down. It has nothing to do with what you were thinking of before. the quicker we let go of any of the hindrances, the less of a rut they make in the mind, and the easier it is to avoid them. The longer we hang on to them, and most people hang on to them all their lives and have no idea that they could let go of them, have people that we call professional worriers. I mean, they just worry, and they've been doing it for so long, they think one has to do that. And usually, if they've done it long enough, one can see it in their faces. They don't have to say a word. The quicker we let go, the better.